I don't want to offend.
What if they misunderstand?
I'm scared to say what I feel.
What's wrong with me?
They're going to see what they want to see.
Everybody else seems fine.
Just say it. This is Jen Slumack. You're listening to the podcast, Just Say It, a show that aims to highlight the commonplaces among us.
Man, everybody's welcome. I don't care who you worship, how you vote, or who you love. Bring an open mind that is willing to listen, reflect, and grow.
As we amplify a variety of voices, conversations, and questions, we hope to make social constructs obsolete and move together toward Dr. King's beloved community. Thank you for tuning in.
Today, my guest is a woman that I ran into unexpectedly, to be honest. I was in a group about social justice, and it was a virtual group, Zooming, if you will, and she was one of the other participants, and we were talking about ways to build community and such, and she shared a story that just caught my attention. So I reached out and I contacted her and I asked her if she would be willing to join me on my podcast and discuss the education system. This was the result. Enjoy.
My name is Kim Boardman. I live in Modesto, California, and I've been a lifetime, well, most of my lifetime member of the Modesto Church of the Brethren, which has had a profound impact on my entire life. The Church of the Brethren, my particular congregation, I'll speak to that specifically, has always been very peace and justice oriented. Historically, the Church of the Brethren is a pacifist community. Very, very, very strong history in that direction, believing that everyone is my brother or sister, made by God. One of the tenets of a Church of the Brethren is to be known by your actions, not by your words, and to live your life in that manner. There isn't that power struggle of well, you're a woman, you do that, I'll do this. I have never had that sense. Others may have. I can't speak for them. So I've been very blessed and being able to pass that on to my children.
And what a gift that really is. So Kim and I met at an online conversation held by an organization called On Earth Peace. They were having a conversation online about Jesus-centered justice. And I was not raised in a world that allowed the mindset for equal contribution to the church, men and women having different roles. My father's a Presbyterian minister. My mother was his wife. She was in the choir and he ran stuff and we all behaved well. Now, that said, I have since in my faith journey learned that many others have had far more rigid stipulations laid down by the church and far more consequences to women stepping out of line or any of those things. I didn't have, abusive roles set in my experience, but there was a clear perspective on who was in charge and who was support. And so you're having this experience of sort of the equality of the contribution is a tremendous gift. And
I would say so, yes.
Having grown up that way, I think is very beneficial to one's development, particularly a woman. As a queer woman seeking faith community, I rarely found spaces where I felt safe to really dive in and learn about the gospel, learn about Jesus Christ without it turning into a pronoun game for me. Staying in the closet, speaking of my spouse or my life circumstances with the appropriate he's and she's, which started to feel so inauthentic and full of lies that how can you be in a Bible study and be fibbing? Or else be in a study and have the study, as soon as I did find the courage to come out, have it turn from the focus of learning about the Bible and instead lovingly trying to guide me back to God and away from
back
my sin.
Back to God, as if you gone away.
Right. So when you and I were on that call, And you shared an experience that you had as a teacher. I do believe that your story drew me so strongly to connect with you outside of that group. And that's why we're here today, because I have had similar experiences when I was teaching in the jail. So if you wouldn't mind telling us about you and sort of lead that into the story that you shared, and then we'll talk about that.
Today is a unique day in my personal history, in that yesterday, even in this time of COVID virus shutdown, yesterday was my last official day of teaching, marked the beginning of my retirement after 32 years of teaching. But this past school year, before the shutdown, being in my 32nd year of teaching, knowing I would be retiring, was honestly one of the hardest years of my career ever, behaviorally. One class in particular challenged me regularly. And when I say one class, those people that have ever spent time in a classroom know that it's really only a few, and the rest of the class is, well, the term I've used is held prisoner, the same as I have been, by those few.
What do you attribute the behavior to? I mean, what you said after 32 years, you'd never had a more difficult class. What do you attribute the change to, if you were to guess, or based on your experience?
One of the students in particular was very definitely a leader, very strong personality, very charismatic, very powerful. And I, to this day, I've lost more sleep over that child than I've lost over a child in a very long time. He was very broken. We had a lot of history together, and a lot of it was very, very, very good. And I knew that he was broken. I knew a lot of his story. His father had very unexpectedly died in his seventh grade year. And we had gone through that with him, we as a school. So we knew, and there was so much going on in his life. We knew that. So many of us were reaching out to him the best we could, but he was shutting down, would not accept help, refused to admit that he needed help. And in his anger and frustration and loss, in his very charismatic leadership style, he chose to make life miserable for everyone around him and do everything he could to get out of the situation. He just was sick of it, I think. And in so doing, he took many, many others with him into the journey of, let's see how far we can take this. It sounds like I'm blaming him. It was a frustration for so many of us that were trying to love him and show compassion, do what we could to support him.
Kim, and this is why I wanted to talk to you, because I think that this young man that you describe is not uniquely situated. I think that we have so many children, my experience teaching in the prisons and the jails with men who were, 18 or older, we had a saying that we used to use among ourselves as teachers. And we would say, all of these students that we have in our classes within the county or the federal system, they've all been in schools first.
Of course.
We would have to learn about trauma. We would have to learn about the impact of trauma on a young body, on a young unsupported person, right? So if a young person is learning that they cannot trust the world around them and the ground beneath their feet at home, right, with the people who are supposed to care for them, and that might mean neglect, that might mean abuse, but that could mean the, like you said, the unexpected death of a father. if this young man had a relationship with his father and then his father was taken from him, and we don't, if I don't know the details of that, all the more difficult if it was violent. Whatever the case is, when somebody is taken from your life that was one of your necessary developmental supports and you didn't have any say in it, then particularly an eighth grade person is going to start stepping into the role of the one in charge in order to maintain some control in a chaotic world. The reality is teachers and often administrators are overwhelmed by the way that the trauma expresses itself. So we used to say, you know, we had to do what we could. And a lot of times our classes, we would do the best that we could to focus on the curriculum. But ultimately, I mean, we became spaces. We had to hold space. We had to hold space for the traumas that have been just one after the other inflicted upon these people without any acknowledgement from the world around them, right? We had to acknowledge them. I spent more time in my class acknowledging their stories. That felt more useful than some of the curriculum. And for a teacher to be overwhelmed and leave the profession within 2 to 3 years like they have been, leaves our schools painfully understaffed, leaves our children abandoned in what was even a safe place once. School was my safe place growing up. My home was very broken, and school was my refuge. And when schools are overwhelmed and cannot be a place of refuge for our children, where do they have to go? One of my favorite guys, Gregory Boyle, I don't know if you know Father Gregory Boyle, but he's the founder of Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles. You know, he was brought on as a minister of a small church in the Mission District when he was a young pastor, and nobody would come to the church, and he got tired of tapping his fingers on the desk waiting for somebody to minister to. So he started walking around the neighborhood, and what he found was, you know, in this extremely poverty-stricken neighborhood, primarily Spanish-speaking, he found that there was women and children, and he wondered where all the men were, and they were incarcerated or they were in gangs away from the family. And it was the only working economy was the gangs. No factories in the area were hiring from the community. And so they started their ministry based on getting jobs, asking the factories, the local employers, to hire people locally. The long and the short of it is, he said he had never met a hopeful young man who joined a gang. What do we do as educators? What do we do in this world now with so much pain and difficulty tangled in our children? The teachers are not equipped to handle.
Right. You and I talked about trust and people who are not hopeful have no trust, in my opinion. The people that they were theoretically supposed to be able to trust and count on have betrayed them or at least disappointed them. And so I think in education, I think I took it as my responsibility to be an adult that my students could trust. If I said I was going to do something, I had to follow through, good, bad, or otherwise, if I had to follow through. And I had to take responsibility for my own behaviors. I think that educators, at the very least, need to be able to say thank you and I'm sorry and mean it to human beings, no matter how old they are, and be reliable. If you say you're going to do something, do it. Be there when you say you're going to be there.
And I think that sometimes can be the chasm. And I don't know what the solution is, but I know the value of structure, particularly in the world of a child who doesn't have it at home, right? So my role becomes to provide structure because I know as an educator and as an adult that structure is necessary in order for us to move and to grow, right? So trying to provide that. So that's my goal and that's my aim. And somehow it continues to miss connecting with the child. We have to understand where each other's coming from better, because we're never going to meet in the middle when our middles are so far away from each other. I had a young man who had just aged out of he had been incarcerated in a youth camp and then turned 18, so came to jail. So he comes into my class, and what I experienced from him, like you said, very charismatic, very smart, very good at corralling folks to his team, right? Definitely the leader of the parade, all qualities which I wanted to celebrate in him, and I would. Here's the thing, what his experience in class appeared to be one where his life had fallen out from beneath him. Everything had proved itself futile. The people in his life that he cared for most had left, some through homicide, some through, not being able to be present through addiction. When parents were gone that way, then he was moved to family, uncles, aunts, and such, who it turned out abused him sexually, to where he was put into the foster care system. And he was put into the foster care system and put into homes that were essentially benefiting from the money they received by accumulating children. And so he learned the skills he was using in my class as he navigated that insanity by himself from 6 years old to, I think, 17 years old is when he finally spoke up for himself about being sexually abused. And not even for himself, because two of his foster siblings who were younger than him, he had become a protector of, and he started fighting the sexual abuser for attacking the children. And he got taken to the youth incarceration camp for attacking, for being violent. So that now he was pegged as violent. He was pegged as defiant. He was pegged as having issues and being angry and unsafe. When this young person's motivation in his pain was to protect these younger, indefensible people to a man who should have been able. So here is this is the journey of.
And how twisted does that get in his brain?
Not only in his brain, but in his body, in his whole reality. So when I say this person is in my classroom and my trying to set structure for them is somehow not meeting them in a middle, I don't have any full grasp of what his middle is. His middle was exhausted 3 foster homes ago. And I see that. And I love him. And I know only love will pull him out from that. And I don't have enough.
My struggle is, how do I make my love into something that they recognize and accept as something they can trust?
How many times do you touch a stove before you learn that hurts? How many times do you put hope in your heart? How many times do you trust somebody who says, you can trust me, before you learn that hurts? And these are the children that many of us get in our classes. And math is not important.
I'll go back to education. It is an institution. Oh, and especially in very crowded classrooms, it is an institution in which we teach to the middle and hope that the kids on the fringe can pick up something. And it's just the way it's designed right now. The frustration is that in my reality, I had 5 classes that were less than an hour long every day, about 150 students each day would cross my path, and every single one of them came from different experiences, different backgrounds, and the state of California said, oh yeah, and you have to talk about these standards. It's a lot going on, and as a teacher, we are making split-second decisions all day, every day, about how I want to present this curriculum, how I want to engage students, and, oh, by the way, did you have breakfast? And, do you have a fever? Oh, my gosh, it's all day, every day. And I struggled with that my whole career. And I used to, when I first started, I asked myself the question constantly. It was like, seriously? In this child's life, how important really is photosynthesis and respiration? Come on. And my answer became extremely important. Because without it and other knowledge, that child doesn't have doors open to them that may help them escape and get out of the cycle that they've found themselves in. So as an instructor, yes, we have to meet the kids where they are and understand that they're broken, but also not apologize for the curriculum and the job that we have to do, because it's there for a reason. People have deemed education important for a reason. And we have to value that and keep it in our minds, knowing that we owe it to these kids to give them a place to start from, to open a few doors.
And this is why I wanted to talk with you, because I want to hear from an instructor, from a teacher. I wonder if you could give the layman, the parent, the listener, just a small overview of the content, the context. You said it's so complex. So in terms of like what, before you're confronted with the emotional issues of a child, those things present themselves urgently all day, that come into conflict with this that I want you to explain to us. Tell me quickly, what is the role of a teacher as described by the state of California? What are you supposed to accomplish in the course of a semester or a unit?
Right. So the state of California has state testing that every student is required to participate in. And in the state of California for science, students are tested in 5th grade, 8th grade, and then in high school, various levels in high school. So for me, I felt a tremendous responsibility to make sure that my 8th graders in particular were prepared for that test. So the standards are those things that the state education department has deemed the most important things that students should know or know how to do. And my job as a teacher would be then to make sure that I cover all of that information in a way in which the students can engage with the information, process it, use it, and make it part of their knowledge. And so in eighth grade, 1 year's curriculum would include genetics and the concept of how genetics makes a living thing what it is and what can happen when things go wrong in genetics, like with mutations. That leads in my world, evolution, natural selection is already a hot topic. So students already come to the classroom with, you know, the hairs on the back of their neck already stand up when you even say the E word, and addressing that, but getting them to a place where they can relax into it and experience it as what the state wants them to understand it to be in terms of a life process and the way things change, and trying to bring the level of anxiety down in relation to that. Oh yeah. And then in eighth grade, in my world, my very next thing was a 2-week unit on, sex ed. Again, very highly charged, but also very fun. I told the kids, it's my favorite part of the year because you are more interested in this than anything else I will talk to you about all year long. And we had fun. Even with that class that caused me so much pain, for 2 weeks, they were my favorite class. And then you get into motion and forces and, there's math involved in that, by the way. And we have a lot of students who struggle with math, and that becomes a whole other issue. And then we finish the year with what's supposed to be space science, and it's exhausting. It's so much fun. And as an educator, what I try to come across with is, oh my God, I am so passionate about this, and I want to share this with you because I love science, and it's amazing, and it's so interesting, and it never ends. And all they want to do is their hair. You know, whatever. So,
tell me about that.
Oh, well, you know, passing period is coming, and that cute boy is going to be out there, and you know, I got to look right and smell right. And middle school is pure chaos in the best of times. They're crazy, crazy kids. And that's the thing. They're kids. They come to the classroom as a pack, and they have that pack mentality, and they feed off each other like wolves a lot of times, and it's amazing how quickly it can become that kind of a thing. Whether it's good or bad, it can be positive too, but they feed off of each other as a pack. And then you meet these kids individually, and they are so young and vulnerable and immature. And as a teacher, I have to constantly remind myself, holy cow, this is a very vulnerable human being that really doesn't know very much and hasn't experienced very much, if they're lucky. My very first principal that hired me 32 years ago said, when he became an administrator, one of the first things he learned is that, especially as middle school teachers, we teach children. We do not teach subjects. Yes, I have standards that the state says I'm required to teach, but ultimately, I teach children.
I think that's right on point with what I said earlier, is that I found that my classroom was far better used witnessing. You know, I taught humans before I taught subjects. So something that you said, Kim, was really interesting, and I'd like to actually go back to it for a second. Teaching middle school and the youth and the vulnerability and the lack of life experience. And then you said, hopefully, right? And so I think that it's two sides of the same coin. When your development has either been, you've been exposed to very little, or your development has been a process of being exposed to way too much. I think those are two sides of the same coin, particularly when put into an environment that, as you said, becomes a group environment very quickly. You know, like if you think about the way that individuals become a group, like sort of, you know, we have to figure out how to connect with each other through what we have and what we don't have. And the child who hasn't seen much feels different already. And the child who has seen too much feels different already. And what happens in that time of our development, whether we've seen not enough or whether we've seen too much, is that we don't understand it. And we feel way more than we understand. And when a physical body, when we're just speaking about biology, when we're speaking about physiology, and we look at a small body that is overwhelmed with feeling and unmet needs that they can't articulate. And so the human experience is one that is always imbalance, seeking balance. And I think a lot of the school shootings, and this is a big leap perhaps, but I think a lot of the school shootings are a result of young people with or without too much life experience wanting to love the other, whichever is the other to them, and not being supported in that process by a world that doesn't seem to see that need. Am I making any sense?
I think it comes down to feeling invisible. And so many children and adults alike feel invisible at one point or another in their lives. I just had a conversation about this yesterday. The students who are so frustrated and lost and trying so desperately to find a way to be heard and have a voice and be seen, and it's crushing because it's so overwhelming.
So if we look at unmet needs in human beings, I see this world full, every protest, every fight, every argument, I see the screaming or the ugly language or the blame. I see all of that. If I were to translate it, my heart translate it as, what about me? I see the world screaming at each other. Yeah, but what about me? And that's a human experience. And we can't hear each other's pain until we understand or are at peace with our own. And so when a teacher is tasked with layers of topics and standards, and the motivation is to give this child a chance, all of that is good. The intentions are good. And I think what needs to be met is, how do we give any of this goodness to a child who has no more capacity for anything? Or adults. You said at the very beginning of this conversation that you were very fortunate to have a experience growing up that afforded you some pretty balanced exposure to things that were very empowering. And there are many people on this planet who also had supported and were exposed to things that allowed them to grow up feeling empowered and feeling good about themselves and their voice and their contribution and their questions. And thank God for that. Because God, where would we be if there weren't some folks that were anchoring us? And also, I believe you are outnumbered.
Oh, I do too. I count my blessings every day.
What is the resource, right? I believe that I am a resource and the source is spirit. But I know that I can't, as a broken person who has exhausted hope and exhausted my willingness to try to trust that person. And I have been her. I'm grateful that I am not her today, but I have been her. That person is very difficult to reach with spirit or with information, because the context of what I present is not valuable. I mean, a lot of these people are sitting in a house that's on fire, and we're trying to teach them, as you said, photosynthesis. And nobody's talking about getting them out of the house that's on fire. And they're terrified. And they don't know which way to go, but they have to pretend that they do.
It's a great question. Honestly, like I said at the very beginning, I'm at a crossroads right now in my life. And I want to travel so bad. I want to see the world and I want to meet people. And that has value in and of itself. But also underlying in my heart and my head, I'm so frustrated with a lack of leadership in almost every aspect of my world. My own school administration has been a great frustration to me in terms of leadership. And so I personally am, you know, coming from, as you said, almost a very privileged perspective. I admit that. I have had exceptional privilege in my life on many levels. And in this point, as I face retirement and who I want to be, who am I going to be when I grow up? I know in my heart I have a supreme responsibility to step up into leadership. But I don't know what that looks like yet. I'm giving myself some space. I already received one phone call about 2 weeks ago to step into a monster leadership within my church denomination. I laughed hysterically when I got the phone call. I was like, really? Wait, not yet, not yet, not yet. But I know in my heart and soul that that's... the spirit, as you say, that's where I am, and that's If I'm going to complain about leadership, then I damn well better be ready to step up and do my part. And I think that anybody who has had any sense of privilege or any sense of healing has the responsibility to step up and be a leader. A respectful, honest, willing to take responsibility leader.
If you were able to design the perfect school system based on what you've noticed in your experience.
Well, first of all, in my perfect school, I would still be a teacher. I would miss too much being out of the classroom. But I would be led by a principal, a leader who was energetic, a very good communicator, someone who had vision of, and set priorities. Okay, I have this vision. These are the three things that we need to do to get there. Let's just worry about those things for now. And for a while, let's sit with it for 3, 4, 5 years before we try to do something else. If this is truly what our vision is, let's do everything in our will and soul and power to make this work and see it through. That would be huge for me. It would include empowering teachers to make curriculum decisions and trusting that they know what they're doing. And I will say again, I have taught in an environment in which I have been exceptionally empowered in that way. And I have expressed my thanks to those that have given it to me many, many, many times, but I think it's vital. In a perfect school, classes would be not too big and not too small. I think I talk about this with my colleagues. Too big is just crowd control or trying to have control. Too small, you lose the capacity for students to be able, who need to, they need to be able to have a space where they can sit quietly and listen and process without sticking out too much. You know, so it, not too big, not too small, 25 maybe. I don't know. I don't know what the perfect number is. It seems about right. So they have space. They're not squished together and not sitting literally almost in each other's laps, can move around freely. But be close enough. You know, middle school kids love to touch each other. And that needs to, you know, be able to happen in an organic way. There needs, in a perfect school, there needs to be a lot of space for personal expression within the classroom and outside of the classroom. At lunchtime, just being able to kind of move as much as you want to some music. On as many silly different levels as possible. We lose track of that, especially with people that are still children and play with toys and who are trying to figure out how to be in relationship. Not only with persons of a gender that, with whom they identify, but with persons of a gender with whom they find to be the opposite. And how in the world do we get along? And how do I get their attention? But giving them a chance to experience that in a safe space. One of the things that I appreciate about middle school, at least the way it's designed now, is that students do have 5 or 6 different teachers, very different personalities, very different teaching styles, different content areas. And not every student is I'm not going to be every student's favorite teacher. That's okay. That's just being human. As long as there is 1 or 2 other teachers that each student can identify with and find as a safe space. And that's the beauty that I've found in a middle school setting, is that they're not with one personality all day long and trying to make it work all year long. So in a perfect school environment, I'll speak from the middle school environment, there would be, and it is, lots of different teaching personalities that students can relate to. A perfect school has high expectations. Here's what I'm going to say that is not popular politically at all, but I think is vital. We have to be able to let students fail in a positive manner and not think we have to save them from that failure, but help them learn from it. I think that's a huge injustice that we do to people all the time. They have to learn how to fail. That's one of the things I wish I could tell parents on a regular basis. Step back, let them cry, let them hurt, let them scream, let them understand the consequences, and then help them know what to do with it. I think a perfect school allows that.
That's huge, Kim. I mean it. No, I asked though, and that's really helpful because I think that you're right. And I mean, it's not a simple question. It's not a quick answer. Let's not forget that I'm speaking to a woman who for 32 years was tasked with helping to turn out the next generations, right? This is no small task. We are dealing with social emotional development and also trying to tack some knowledge of how the world works onto that intellectually, right? So the learning has to be both. And what I hear you saying very clearly that I think is, I agree with, I think is critical, is that we have got to allow them space, students in general, particularly youth, space to learn that being human is to be imperfect. And nobody is telling a child, you want that? You have to look at how many times that person took a risk, failed, cried, beat the concrete. And that process takes work. As parents, we are merely children who have grown up with the skills that most of our junior high children have, because we have failed to continue to take risks past that age, because emotionally the lack of needs being met was so intense that we just shut down. But our bodies kept growing in spite of that. And we certainly have parents that are of the same caliber of development and maturity. And this is not a judgment. This is an observation. And when we're dealing with big people who have the emotional maturity of maybe high schoolers, who are desperately seeking a place to belong instead of having resolved that and operating from a place of responsibility for their role. Then we have parents who are trying to make their children their friends. We have teachers who are apologizing to students for upsetting them. I think it's entirely different, by the way, which you said that you like to apologize when you make mistakes. I think that's entirely different than apologizing for upsetting somebody. I also would own my errors in class. I think it's a responsibility to model that. But I mean, this stuff is so deep. And it's not just a matter of, you know, sending our kids to school.
A few years ago, probably about 5 years ago now, my school district hosted workshops, trainings in a program called Capturing Kids' Hearts. It's a whole program, not a program, but a process of dealing with classroom functioning, basically. It's a nationwide program, and but one seemingly very small element of that program that became exceptionally important to me was greeting every student at the door with a handshake every day. And when I was first introduced to that concept, I just thought, there is no way I can do that. Between classes, I'm getting ready for my next class and setting up the lab and cleaning up things. And I was like, I can't. There's no way I can do it. And then I shifted my thinking and said, you know what? There's no way I can't. And made myself do it. And it was profound for me and my students. Guess what? I found the time and ability to get ready for my next class anyway, but I greeted my students at the door with a handshake every day, which meant I was saying their name, I was looking them in the face, I was acknowledging them, even if it was for 5 seconds, as they came in, and for some students, it was excruciatingly uncomfortable. But even those students, I said, I will acknowledge you every day, at least in this way. And so I have two related stories to that. One is one day I had, within a classroom lab activity, one of my classes that had just left, I discovered some of the equipment had been quite intentionally destroyed. It wasn't expensive stuff. It really was not expensive, but it made it so that it was going to be complicated to let my other classes do the activity. And there was a whole lot of blaming going on. And I blamed the class that had just come in. And they were staring at me going, no, no, no. And then found out that some students had basically lied to me and said, no, it wasn't us, it wasn't us. And then I blamed this other group. It was very complicated, but when I found out the truth, the next day, when that class came in that I had discovered had lied to me, I did not shake their hands. I met them at the door and I said, come on in. And they were shocked. They looked at me and there was no handshake. And I was like, nope, not today. And I began the class by saying, you know what? I looked up the history of handshaking and what it meant. And it comes, as far as people know, it comes from people, strangers meeting And when they reached out their hand, it was their way of saying they were not carrying a weapon, that they came in peace, and that's how they were meeting, was in peace. And it's a sign of trust. And I said, we had a break of trust yesterday, and I don't shake hands with people I don't trust. And I could tell they were crushed. They looked at each other and looked at each other until finally one boy stood up and he said, it was me, it was me. I'm sorry, it was me. And all I could do was look at him and say, thank you. That's all I wanted. And I'm so proud of you for taking responsibility. And that boy and I moved forward in the most fabulous way. A couple of years later, I had a girl who had come late in the school year. I knew she was struggling. She was sad. And I didn't know the full story, but I knew that things at home were difficult and she was really, really, really struggling. Last day of school, after everyone was gone, she came back into my classroom by herself and with intent. And she said, Mrs. Boardman, I just wanted to say thank you. And she said, every day that I came to school was hard for me. And I would sit in my first class and I would be almost in tears thinking, I need to go home. I need to go home. And she said, I just kept telling myself, hang on, because Mrs. Boardman will meet me with a smile and I'll be able to make it. And that was profound, of course, because I had no idea that I was impacting that child like that. And that's what it's all about, is trying desperately to make a safe space for all the broken humans.
Thank you for sharing those stories. I think it's so important. You have inspired me. I would like to share, if I can find it quickly. I had a teacher who I believe saved my life. And I wrote about her.
I'm so glad.
In my book. And I would like to read a piece of what, of my sort of ode to her, if I can find it. So it's about 3.5 pages, so this is quite a reading. But if you don't mind, I think I'd like to end our time with this. And I offer my tribute and my love and my gratitude for, frankly, my life to this teacher, Miss Belser. We lost her at 42 to breast cancer. Thank God. It says, I was attracted to powerful women. There were many at that school, teachers who were wise and commanding, black women who seemed to run things. I wanted to be like them. In all of my daydreams about being an adult, I started to notice that I was imagining myself a beautiful black woman with style and power. As the impossibility of my becoming such an adult was clear, another layer of conscious discomfort emerged, wearing fair skin. This was a self-perceived shortcoming that she never shamed me about. I always felt like I held great possibility in Miss Belser's presence. From time to time, my dad would drop me off late, and I'd have to come and I'd have to open the classroom door, disturbing a lesson as I got to my seat. While I was hot with embarrassment and felt like everybody was staring at me, I soon remembered that I was finally safe in class, in a seat that belonged to me. Even in my absence, no one else would sit there because it was mine. I had a place that I didn't need to defend or justify. My name was on the roster. My role was student. My teacher was in charge. My job was to learn. It was all very clear. The clarity was welcomed and appreciated. Once I stayed after school to help Miss Belzer grade papers, and when we were done, I called home for a ride. Nobody answered, so my teacher decided to drive me home. I was on top of the world that my realities were about to merge. My teacher would see where I lived, and maybe one day she would come and take me away. Her car smelled like cigarettes from an overflowing ashtray in the front seat. She asked me to sit in the back. She told me that she smoked cigarettes and it was a bad habit. She hoped that I would make better decisions than she had. I told her I didn't mind. I told her my mom smoked cigarettes too. She was asking about my homework when I saw her look in the rearview mirror and say something under her breath. Then I heard a siren blip a few times and I felt scared inside. "Everything's okay, Jenny. Just be quiet and sit still, baby. Okay?" I did as she asked. An officer came to the window and asked her a question. She shuffled around in her front seat and handed him something, then sat looking straight ahead with her hands on the wheel. The tension was familiar somehow, and I held all of my questions and concerns. I bit the inside of my cheeks to stay quiet like she'd asked, but suddenly I wanted to take care of her. Her energy felt different than I'd ever felt from her before. It felt like she needed protection, but I sat still. She lit a cigarette. The officer returned to her door and asked her to step out of the car. I almost blurted out, "Where are you taking her?" But I honored her instructions instead. I was afraid, frozen. Once she was out of the car, I got up on my knees and turned around to see them talking by his car. Two white officers stood facing her, one with his arms crossed. She had her hands behind her back and she was nodding to the second officer whose hands were pointing to me in her car. Was he speaking to her or screaming? She would begin to speak, then stop. Begin, get cut off, and stop. She looked over and saw my eyes reading the moment. I wondered, why was she acting that way? I had never seen her like this. My powerhouse teacher was submissive. The talkative officer got back in their patrol car, and it looked like he was on a phone talking to someone. His eyes stayed affixed to Miss Belzer, and he was nodding his head. The other officer stood sternly with his arms crossed, not speaking. He looked like he was a guard, but I didn't know what he was guarding. Miss Belzer didn't move. Suddenly, the two men in uniform were smiling and laughing. It looked like they were trying to be nice, but my teacher didn't look amused. She looked small next to the officers until her arm came away from her body and she pointed back toward me in the car. I watched her suddenly remember who she was, and I saw her inflate to the woman I admired. She reached out her hand to the officers, who each took it one at a time. She smiled politely, and then she marched back to the car. Her eyes immediately caught mine, and her hand made a hidden motion in front of her body that only I could see. It told me to turn around and sit down now. The rest of the car ride home was quiet, and I could feel a change in her. There were no words for the moment, none that I could find. She helped by saying under her breath, but loud enough so I could hear, "A black woman can't drive a white child home from school without looking like a kidnapper." I was confused. Why did the police think you were kidnapping me? I heard her take a deep breath, twice. Her exhale was loud and slow. When we pulled over in front of my house, Miss Belzer stretched her arm around the front seat and turned to look at me. "Jenny, do you know what the word adversity means?" I was happy she was talking to me, relieved that I didn't have to peel myself out of the thick silence that we'd been sitting in. "No. Adversity means difficulties, hard stuff, the kind of stuff that hurts your heart. Do you know what that is?" It took me a moment to answer because I needed to wrap my head around it. There's a word for the way I feel? Yes, I do know what that is. I know you do, baby. Now you listen to me. Her eyes were stern but warm, and her red fingernail was pointing at me to drive her thought home. Whatever she was about to say was meant to stick. I gave her every ounce of my attention. Jenny, you have a light inside of you, a special light, like a bright flame on a candle, and adversity will try to extinguish that. Adversity will try to blow that light out. I knew what she was talking about. You promise me, Jennifer. Promise me that no matter what, you won't let that light inside of you go out. You got to shine. I wanted to climb over the seat and hug her. I wanted to thank her for saying words that stitched my two worlds together, my insides, the outside. I couldn't believe that she knew exactly what I needed. Are you okay? Did those policemen give you adversity? She chuckled and puckered her lips into a face that she made when she got a kick out of me. They try, baby. They try. But I got a light, too, and they can't have it. I was so glad. I loved her light. Jenny, now you promise me. I saw my mother descending our front steps and walking toward the car. I didn't want to leave this pocket of truth. I promise. Okay now, baby. Your mom's come to get you. I'll see you in class. Be good. My mother bent down and waved to my teacher as I ran into the house, determined to get to my room and close the door so I could continue to marinate in Miss Belzer's confidence and acknowledgement. When I got to the top of the stairs, I looked down and Mom was leaning in the passenger window talking to my teacher, grateful, hopeful. I closed the door. This is the role that teachers play. This is the role that teachers play in our lives. Thank you for your time today, Kim.
Thank you for your light, Jen. Thank you for the invitation. This was profound for me. Just the invitation.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you on many levels, and I lift up what you've done for the last 32 years, and I appreciate you for that, for loving and caring and directing our children. And, you know, let that time and that cushion take its time before you step into your next big role. Take a little time for you. God bless you, Ma.
Be well, sister.
This has been another episode of Just Say It. I am your host, Jen Slumak, and I want to thank you for coming by. I encourage you to go to my website, www.soulnotskin.com. Tell your friends if you enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next time.